Olá, bem-vindos, boa noite. Olha, foi a crítica mais devastadora de todos os tempos. E olha que o livro era legal, não era de leitura fácil, mas tinha muito humor, marca do autor. O crítico, todo poderoso, não se contentou em destruir o livro, pediu a cabeça do escritor, literalmente. O livro chamava-se Versos Satânicos e o raivoso crítico literário era o mais poderoso clérigo do islamismo fundamentalista, o líder da revolução iraniana, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. O romance foi acusado de blasfêmia por satirizar o profeta Maomé. A gente sabe que fazer piada com figuras santas é um risco, provoca a ira de fiéis. No caso do Ayatollah, ele emitiu uma fátua, uma sentença fatal que ordenava a qualquer muçulmano do mundo que tivesse a chance que matasse o escritor. 32 anos depois, ele, graças, está vivo e bem disposto, ativo em sua escrita até hoje. Britânico, nascido na Índia, radicado nos Estados Unidos, dele acaba de ser lançado no Brasil seu romance mais recente, o saboroso Quixote. Uma reencarnação yankee e contemporânea do Dom Quixote de Miguel de Cervantes. É uma honra rever Salman Rushdie. Hello, Mr. Rushdie.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very happy to be with you today. Thank you so much for your patience.
I'm happy to be here.
Where are you speaking from?
From New York City.
Is this your permanent address now?
Yeah, this is the room where I work.
You've been in the States, it's been already 20 years?
More than that, 21 years, yeah.
21 years. Would it be correct to call your latest novel, just released in Brazil, Quixote, your American novel?
Well, it's one of a sequence, you know, because I mean I've written a sequence of American novels, but what happened is the two of the novels that came before this were almost entirely set in New York City. You know, they were very much centered on New York City. And I remember even when I was writing the book before, which was The Golden House, I thought to myself, if you're going to write another New York novel, you have to get out of the city. You have to look at the country in a wider way.
Because actually New York is not America, I mean.
Well, it's one of the Americas, you know, there are many Americas. And one of the things that I felt, I think many people feel living here now, is that it's a very divided country, you know, and I wanted to let the novel go on, explore across those divisions.
Divided countries. So are we nowadays in Brazil.
Yeah.
You certainly can't remember this, but we met before in London, early March 1996. I was escorted by Scotland Yard's agents to a secret spot in a well-guarded place where we had our interview. So I'll show you how I was brought to your acquaintance. Let's have a look.
7 anos depois, Rushdie continua escondido sob a proteção da polícia secreta britânica. Para chegar a Salman Rushdie, marcamos um encontro com os agentes ingleses no centro de Londres. De lá, somos levados ao local da entrevista. A caminho, o agente telefona para seus colegas confirmando local e horário. Chegamos à porta dos fundos de um dos hotéis mais tradicionais de Londres. Depois de longos corredores, entramos no quarto alugado para a entrevista. A suíte onde Napoleão III viveu seu exílio. O homem exilado em seu próprio país chega logo depois. Pálpebras caídas, Rushdie tem um olhar estranho, o que os ingleses chamam de olhos encapuzados.
3 years later, you had the surgery to correct your eyes condition. What could have happened if you didn't do this surgery?
It's just a muscle problem, you know. It's a muscle problem in the eyelid that had to be rectified. And that would have got weaker and weaker, basically, if I hadn't done something about it. But goodness, that feels like 100 years ago, you know. I've been living now in New York for more than 2 decades, and there's none of that nonsense anymore.
That's a relief. But actually, the fatwa died with Ayatollah Khomeini. It was never officially revoked. But your life nowadays, you don't have any security restraints, or you can lead a normal and free life.
You know, really, the only time it ever comes up is when I'm doing interviews.
I do apologize. But when you walk around New York City, which is a city full of Muslims, that doesn't create any kind of situation, hopefully.
No, it doesn't. I mean, look, the world is very multicultural now. All cities are full of everybody, you know. In a way, I'm sad that we're talking about it, because this is ancient history to me.
I'm sorry to bring that back to you, but it was something that impressed me a lot, because you told me about a recurring dream you had at the time. I'll show you how it was portrayed in the report.
Estou nadando debaixo d'água e descubro que acima só há terra. Então não posso subir à tona para respirar. Tenho que continuar nadando até que me dou conta de que meu fôlego não será suficiente para alcançar mar aberto.
But then you told me that at the end of the nightmare you managed to find extra breath to finally rise to the surface. Did you get rid of these dreams? What kind of dreams do you have today?
Yeah, no, I don't have. I have very boring dreams nowadays. In my dream, I read the newspaper.
At the end of the day, how many years were you forced to stay in isolation? Has pandemic social isolation anything to do with your ordeal more than 30 years ago?
You know, not really. I mean, first of all, that was a case of an attack on an individual. This is a thing that the whole world is having to face, you know. I mean, I've lived in this city which was very, very badly hit a year ago. I mean, a year ago, New York was, in a way, one of the most dangerous places in the United States, you know, to be. And now, strangely, it's the exact reverse, that New York is one of the safest places to be, one of the places where the pandemic is receding fastest. Because here, people have been very sensible. You know, everybody has got vaccinated, and people have behaved properly with masking and so on, you know.
I must confess that for us Brazilians, this provokes the noble sentiment of envy.
Yeah, well, you know, what it shows is that when these things are run properly, we can get past them, you know. And an enormous amount of the problem in America has been that it has been very badly run, that people have lied about the statistics. People have been negligent instead of being attentive. It just shows you that once you have a real government in place in America, the efficiency with which the vaccine has been rolled out has transformed things.
Listen, your latest novel, Quixote, it should be said with a French accent. You have this disclaimer at the beginning. Brings over one of the greatest literary characters of all time, from Spain to contemporary America. How modern the original Quixote still is?
You know, it's quite shockingly modern in some ways. First of all, formally, in some ways, it's almost postmodern, because there's a particularly in the second volume of Cervantes's book, the characters, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, become conscious of the fact that they are written about in books, you know, and they have opinions, strong opinions about the books which they're written about in.
And they meet readers of the first part.
Exactly. I mean, that's so extraordinarily contemporary, that the fact that this great writer was able to imagine that kind of literature more than 400 years ago is amazing. I also think, you know, the other book that I thought about, which is not in the title of the book, that is important, is Voltaire's novel Candide, because Candide is also a novel about kind of an innocent traveling through a very, very guilty world, if you like, you know. Again, what they both share, Don Quixote and Candide, is a quality of absurd optimism. just kind of ridiculous optimism when there's nothing to be optimistic about. You know, I have friends who say to me that I'm like that.
Are you?
That, you know, by nature, I'm optimistic.
One would say that all optimism is absurd.
Yes, exactly. So I thought, let me, if that is what people make fun of me about, that I have this kind of absurd optimism, let me just take that quality and connect it to the optimism of earlier characters in literature and magnify it, make it bigger. You know, so you have this, my Quichotte is crazily optimistic. I mean, he believes he can win the love of this woman who is a celebrity and who he's never met and who is completely out of his league. But he believes that love will find a way, you know, and travels across America to prove it. No, and as he travels, he meets all kinds of people, many of whom are quite unpleasant, but he greets them always with hope. And I thought to contrast that hopefulness with the darker aspects of the society would be valuable.
And her name is very similar to your name.
Yeah. You know, I'm always being asked which is the autobiographical character in the novel. So I thought this time I'd make the autobiographical character a woman who is a drug addict, and so on. So
does she have anything to do with your late sister?
Well, what happened to me? I mean, it's now a long time ago. It's now like 12 years ago. Is that my youngest sister became as I only discovered this after she died, that she had become addicted to these very powerful painkillers, you know, to these opioids. And she died of relatively young. I mean, she wasn't even 50 years old. And she died of what almost certainly was an opioid overdose. And only when she died, which was like sudden because she was young, she had no reason to die, you know, only after that we discovered the scale of her addiction, you know, and to be frank, it made that issue a very personal issue for me, you know, because you can imagine it was a big shock in the family and so on, and so then I began to research and I began to dig around, try and find out about these things and how they spread and so on, and then I mean, frankly, it took me 10 years to find a way of using it in a book. You know, so it finally came out, and by some strange, one of the strange coincidences of life, just at the moment at which the book came out, suddenly it's as if the world woke up to the opioid crisis, and they started arresting people who had been responsible for propagating this thing. I mean, actually, the character in my book, the crooked doctor, who propagates one opioid, is based on a real story. I mean, that's to say that when I was doing this research, I found that there was, in fact, an Indian-American doctor who had been doing this, you know, with a very, very powerful opioid. And so he becomes the basis of my Dr. Smile. And at just about the same time as the book came out, the real-life character was arrested and sent to jail. Finally, I mean, after he'd become a billionaire.
That's amazing.
Just so such a strange coincidence.
It's unbelievable. Well, back then you also told me that your first literary passion was a book that began with the sentence, Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank. Yeah. Quichotte begins with, there once lived, the classic storytelling beginning. Yeah. Your most revered book, Midnight's Children, also sets off on a similar note. I was born in the city of Bombay. Once upon a time, in Portuguese, era uma vez. Mm. The first sentence you write usually ends up being the actual first sentence at the final book?
Not always, no. I mean, sometimes I discover the beginning much later. You know, I mean, for example, when I was writing the Satanic Verses, for example, the scene with which it now begins, with these two men falling out of the sky from an exploded aircraft. I mean, I'd written more than 100 pages of the book when that scene showed up on my typewriter And I remember thinking, what is this doing here? This, why am I writing this now? And then I thought, actually, this scene would be much better if the book was to begin with it. And so I moved it to the beginning, and that meant I had to revise all the other 100 pages in order to follow on from it. I mean, when I wrote, in fact, if we met in 1996, the book I would just have published would have been The Moor's Last Sigh.
That's right.
What I remember about that book is that the beginning and the end, I knew immediately. You know, that almost the first things I wrote were like the first paragraph and the last paragraph. And what it did in a strange way was to tell me the kind of arc that the story had to go on. It had to start here, it had to end here. So let's see how we get from here to there. So every book comes differently, you know? I mean, in the case of this book, you know, when I first was thinking about it, I hadn't even thought about Cervantes. You know, I'd thought about doing a novel about characters journeying across America, but I had no sense of Don Quixote or anything like that. And then by a kind of accident, somebody asked me to write something about Cervantes because it was an anniversary of his. You know, a few, well, 4 or 5 years ago, there was an anniversary of both Cervantes and Shakespeare.
And Shakespeare.
Yeah. And somebody asked me to write a piece comparing and contrasting these two great geniuses, you know. So because of that, I thought I have to read this book again. I haven't read it since I was 25 or something, you know. So I took it down off the shelf to look at it in order to write this essay. And then I thought, oh, but this fits perfectly with the book that I'm thinking about.
Do you remember the encounter Anthony Burgess promoted between Shakespeare and Cervantes?
Yes, yes.
Shakespeare says, I wrote many tragedies, and Cervantes replies, I wrote just one comedy. Only comedy is divine.
Exactly. You know, what is interesting, it seems probable that Shakespeare had read Cervantes. Because there was a translation of Don Quixote in English in the lifetime of Shakespeare. And actually, there is a lost play of Shakespeare which has the name of one of the major secondary characters in Don Quixote. So it's possible, probable, that Shakespeare had some knowledge of Cervantes. But it doesn't seem at all probable that Cervantes knew anything about Shakespeare.
Do you actually have fun while you write? Because some writers say that to write is suffering. To have written, it's fun, but not to write. What about you?
No, well, look, both things are true. It is very, very hard. You know, I mean, writing is the hardest thing that I know how to do. But at the same time, there are days when you feel very happy at the end of the day. You know, and there are other days when not so happy. You know, but. I mean, I always said in the movie Shakespeare in Love, there's a scene which I always liked where Shakespeare is writing in his attic, you know, and he's writing the play we afterwards learn is Romeo and Juliet. And he finishes writing and he jumps up from his chair and he kind of snaps his fingers like that. And he says, God, I'm good.
That's lovely.
And I thought, you know, we're not all Shakespeare, so it doesn't happen very often. But there are moments when you feel like that, you know.
Do you have a routine? Are you very disciplined?
Yes, yes, I am that. I mean, and that has also changed with the passing years, you know. I mean, now I'm very disciplined. Now I get up in the morning and I work, you know, and I set myself deliberately quite a low target for how much I can do in a day. You know, I mean, if I can write a page in a day, I'm happy. Some days, like these days, the finger snapping days, you know, maybe you can write a bit more, you know, because the book seems to flow. But what I know is that if I just keep my concentration and focus, then in a day I could, I mean, a page is what? Like 300 words or so, you know? If I can do that in a day, I'm happy. I mean, of course, I mean, for some writers, that feels like nothing. And for some writers, that feels like quite a lot. I mean, famously, Flaubert used to be happy if he wrote a sentence in a day. Yeah. You know, so.
One page is good enough. If it's a good page, you don't have to rewrite it too many times.
Yeah.
Listen, you are a severe critic of social media, but nevertheless, you keep very active on Twitter. Why? And why is social media leading us to dystopia?
Well, actually, I'm not very active. What really surprised
used to be.
Me? Yeah, I used to be, and then I got fed up of it, and now I use it only for very specific purposes. You know, so now if I have a book coming out, I use it to inform readers of that. If I'm giving a lecture, or in the days when one had book tours, I would tell people where I would be and when. And nowadays, actually, in the recent weeks, I've been using it to try and raise money for the Indian catastrophe. But otherwise, I don't really. But, you know, it's kind of useful to have a million people that you can talk to, you know. But what I think is the problem is that, in a way, it's created a world of incivility, you know, where people are very rude to each other from behind anonymity. You know, because everybody has a fake name, you know, on Twitter, or lots of people do, and it's gone some way, I think, to creating the kind of hostility of society at the moment, and also a kind of lynch mob mentality where people rush after people to abuse them, you know, and this is a way in which people would not behave if they were in the room with you, if they were actually in your company and you knew them and you knew their name, they would not behave like this. You know, so somehow social media unleashes a kind of dark side of the human race, and it's become worrying. You know,
you have recently subscribed an open letter against the so-called cancellation culture. Were you cancelled for that?
No, I mean, listen, I'm too old for this nonsense. I mean, I'm happy to say that I seem to have readers who just are interested and they follow my work, and that's kind of plenty, you know, for any writer, that's plenty. I mean, you know, I was very lucky as a writer in that when I was quite young, my second novel had a big success. And so ever since then, really, I've been able to live by my pen, you know. I mean, many writers can't say that. Many very wonderful writers, you know, have to take jobs in universities and things like that in order to pay the bills, you know. So I've always thought that, you know, that in many ways I've been a very fortunate writer, you know, in the freedom that I have to work.
Back to memories of our 1996 conversation, I recall quoting a sentence from the Satanic Verses, the only force that can defeat fanaticism is corruption. Then I asked you, what would defeat corruption? And you replied...
I can't remember. What did I say?
Fanaticism.
Fanaticism would be that. No, I mean, actually, in the novel, it's not something I'm saying. It's something one of the characters is saying.
Yeah, it's a joke.
But I remember where it comes from. Is I remember being in India talking to journalist friends of mine. And one of the, I mean, very senior journalists made this joke. He said, you know, in India, there's so much corruption that it's the only thing that can defeat religious fanaticism. You know, you sit the fanatics down and you open your checkbook and you say, how many zeros?
But now in many parts of the world, notably in Brazil, fanaticism and corruption are hand to hand, are main features of political life on the right, on the left.
That's why the joke doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Would you tell me anything that could bring us some hope about that?
I really don't know in detail. I mean, obviously, I know about the what's happening in Brazil and the government and so on. What happened here under the previous administration was very frightening, because in those years, if you had asked me, is this the new America? Is this now normality? Or is this in some way an aberration? You know, a kind of political mistake. You know, I would have said, I don't know which one it is. You know, I actually can't tell you which one it is. So the election gave one some hope, because, you know, even though there was a big vote for the previous president, there was a vote of 8 million people more against him. So that's hopeful. But I mean, there's still great danger. You feel in America the presence of that far right every day. you know, and its ruthlessness and its refusal to accept reality and truth. And that's very dangerous for the future. You know? So I think just because we got rid of one idiot doesn't mean that the next idiot isn't waiting. In Brazil, maybe you can do the same.
We are precisely at the same cul-de-sac. One third, and the middle ground to be conquered next year. But we really don't know what's going to happen.
No. I must say, it feels better in America since January. You know, it feels like there's a kind of decency that is back at the head of the society, you know, and you don't have to wake up every morning wondering what has the president said today.
I mean,
the fact that you don't have to worry about what the president is saying is an enormous relief. We don't have to think about Joe Biden every day, you know. We can just get on with our lives.
Listen, for a long time you carried with you a letter your father once wrote you. And your father wasn't really fond, wasn't really glad about your idea of becoming a writer. What did his letter say?
Well, what was interesting is that he had never really talked to me about my writing. When I first said that that's what I wanted to do, he was, to say the least, not in favor of the idea. I remember he said with a kind of anguish, he said, "What will I tell my friends?"
What'd you say?
I mean, fortunately, he lived long enough to see the success of Midnight's Children and so on. And so his friends started calling him to congratulate him. And so that sort of helped. But what happened is on my 40th birthday, which was in June of 1987, he wrote me this letter in which I realized for the first time that he had read every word that I'd ever written many times and had thought about it very seriously, you know, and he wrote me this letter about my work, which it completely blew me away because I had no idea that he had engaged with it so deeply. And it was very moving. And then, you know, that was June, and in November of that year, he died. So it was just 5 months before his death that I finally found out that he had actually cared about what I was doing, because he never spoke to me about it, never did.
That's very touching. Mm. So he was proud of you after all.
It turns out that he was. He just had trouble expressing it.
You think of him often?
Yes, of course. You know, I mean, he's my only father and I was his only son. So it's a very close, and I think in some ways I'm like him, you know. And even my family name, you know, he invented the family name. Rushdie was, my grandfather wasn't called Rushdie.
Really?
Yeah. My father decided to name himself after the great Arab philosopher Ibn Rushd, Averroes in the West, and made Rushdie means of Rushd, you know. So... And then when I came to read about this great philosopher, I discovered how much I had in common with him, you know, and how my father had chosen exactly the right person to my father invented the family name. So I have that too.
That's so delightful. It's incredible. What a character.
Yes,
your
he
father.
Was.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mr. Rushdie. What a pleasure to talk to you. Take care of yourself. Thank you so much for your time. I miss New York, and I would love to be... Oh, next time, I would love to do it face-to-face.
Face-to-face. And I'd love... I miss Brazil, and I hope that that health and sanity returns to your beautiful country.
We too. We'll always have Paraty.
We will. I mean, I love those visits to Paraty, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, fortunately, I have a wonderful Brazilian publisher who has helped me know and understand a bit about Brazil. So, and I can't wait to get back.
He's a great guy. Have you read his book, his memoirs?
I haven't read it yet because I don't know that I don't have an English version. But
yeah. It's a great book. You're going to enjoy it.
I'm very glad. Yeah. Well, hello, Luis.
Ciao, Luis. Muito obrigado a todos. Um abraço.
Gostou da conversa? No Globoplay você pode acompanhar e também ver as imagens de tudo que rolou. Até lá.